just want you to know that I'm happy to see such a great turnout. It's a really special night for us. We're all going to learn a lot because we have five presenters of different programs within our county. People who really have a heart and an interest in caring about how to help our loved ones. And as we grow in our NAMI work and we build community and we help develop a common language, a common understanding of recovery, of cooperation, of collaboration, I just think there's nothing more important than all of us getting to know each other as family members, as peers, and as providers. So I'd like to ask you to help me welcome a big round of applause for all of our speakers tonight that are going to help us out. So a couple of announcements. Family to family class, I want to say thank you guys. Everybody stand up who gave up their class to be here tonight. If you're in the current gathering, let's hear it for them. Yay. And look at how they all just sat right here. Yeah. Well, that's wonderful. So teacher Linda and your partner is
Jenny.
So, we have some great congratulations for graduates that Cheryl has been introduced people who just completed new training programs. Part of our growth is to have you guys to take classes, become volunteers, and pay it forward, pass it on. So some success in that note is...
So we have a few people who have... What works for me? We have a few people who've graduated, and so now they're trained volunteers because our free programs are run by trained volunteers, and honestly, we couldn't do it without all the wonderful people giving back to the community, and we encourage you to learn more about our programs so that you too can be a volunteer. But Suzanne Williams has graduated from the support facilitation training. For a support group for family members whose loved ones are considering residential or therapeutic boarding school or wilderness programs. So it's primarily geared for parents of youth. And she's also going to be helping out with our general parents of youth group. Then we have Julie Miller-Soras and Naomi LaBelle. Naomi LaBelle, are they here tonight? So they recently graduated from the family-to-family teacher training, so they'll be coming to a class near you. And then finally, we have four people who are now our interim voice presenters, so they share their story. They go to a two-day training in order to craft their story. And the idea behind that is to kind of educate and give people hope that their recovery is possible. And they are Taylor Santo, Asako Knees-Leggett, Carrie Jensen, and Angie Arneson. Are they here today? Well, we're grateful for their contributions and all of the other volunteers for NAMI. Thank you very much.
Okay, so on with our program tonight. Oh, did you want to say something about Human Race?
Did you want to? I can.
Human Race is coming up May 9th. Can hardly wait. It's going to be fun. We need all your participation, all your help with fundraising, and walking on that day.
Yeah.
You'll be getting stuff in the mail, in the emails about how to help us and how to be part of the fun.
Right. And you can be part of the fun right now. If you want to, you can grab one of these brochures on your way out and maybe help us fundraise or contribute to it. It's really fun, actually. It's not just us. It's a whole bunch of nonprofits. And there's music and there's some festivals. It's really a fun day. So if you can, come out and support us, we'd really appreciate it.
Okay, now, I want to introduce for you our first speaker of the evening is Marty Riggs, right? Who's going to introduce the rest of the team. Marty is the Acute Services Program Manager for County Mental Health. He's the person that has to make a lot of very tough decisions about when, who goes where. And in our environment of inadequate facilities, inadequate housing options, There are always log jams. There's always stress. It's really a painful situation, and he is a very kind-hearted person, always looking to find the right solutions for as many people as possible. And we appreciate all, he used to be in children's mental health, right, Marty?
Most of my career.
Most of his career. So this year, this past year, he's been in this new role helping Pam Rogers Wyman, and I'd like you all to know him. So Marty, please take it from here. Whenever you want.
Yeah. So I'm thinking we'll just have the whole panel come up and at least get settled in. I mean, that's my thought. So while that's happening, hi, I'm Marty. I'm here to kind of give some information tonight. And I should say that I have been a children's clinician for most of my life, and just in the last year, I decided to become an administrator, which is a big transition for me. And also administrator working within adult services and adult systems. So, and I'm learning a lot, and so I hope I have answers when the questions come. And if I don't have answers tonight, I will find them and get them back to you later. I promise my best to do that. And I wanted to just kind of, I'll introduce in a minute. I wanted to ask people, because I was just kind of, I think language is really important, and wanting to kind of, be sensitive about language and how language is used and stuff. So I'm just curious, how many people here use the term neurobiological disorder? Are familiar with that? Oh, no one. Oh, yes. Okay. And how many people here use the term like psychiatric disability? Okay, and then how many people use the term mental illness? Okay, all right. Is there another one I'm missing? Because I'm just...
Over here.
Yes.
I say brain disorder.
Brain disorder, okay. Any other? I was just curious. Okay. Because in my research, I did a web search and stuff like that, and I heard that neurobiological was the new politically correct, but I was surprised that...
I just call it a brain chemistry disorder.
Brain chemistry disorder. Okay. Thank you. Anyway, so I want to introduce... So we'll kind of do our panel, and we have David here from... God, I'm already getting nervous. I've got my cheat sheet here, yes. So we have David McBride from the Telos Center, and then we have David Campbell from El Dorado Center. We have Adrian Kemp from Second Story, and we have Cassie Bloom from, I've forgotten the name of the Coastal Turning Point. So what we're going to try to do is I'm going to give like a little bit of an overview of county services, and then... And then we'll break it up into each person can talk about their own particular program. So we can hopefully give you a fair amount of information about kind of pre-hospitalization, post-hospitalization, resources that are in the community. And then to the best of our ability, if we could kind of hold questions to the end, that would be really helpful. So if you really kind of, I encourage you to kind of lock it into your brain if you think it's a good question and kind of, you know, maybe even write it down or something like that. If it's an absolute burning desire, maybe we can address it in the moment, but I would prefer, we'll give a big chunk of time at the end to answer questions. So, So I'm supposed to be addressing kind of general acute services, so we can go to the first slide. So I'm just going to give an overview. So basically, as far as...
In the first row.
Oh,
I'm sorry.
That's all right.
Yeah. I'll read what it says.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
So it says Santa Cruz Telecare Crisis Stabilization Program. Telecare operates a crisis assessment, intervention, and stabilization program with the capacity for up to 8 adults. And then we have Santa Cruz Telecare Psychiatric.
So how many people are familiar with the CSP or the Crisis Stabilization Program? Okay. So basically, for instance, that's kind of the first point of contact if there's a hold written on someone, a psychiatric hold, and or if somebody comes in voluntarily because they're having a really acute or difficult situation and they know that they don't have enough care and they need more care. So, and
okay.
That's the kind of the evaluation center.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And there's a, we had a talk last, a couple months ago, and that's on our website too, a recording of that talk for those who missed it. And then the second part of that facility is the psychiatric health facility. And that one is a 16-bed facility operated by Telecare, operates and provides comprehensive inpatient treatment.
And so that's the in-county inpatient unit. And then probably some people are familiar that also that sometimes when things are full and also sometimes with non-Medi-Cal clients, consumers, that those folks kind of go out to other Bay Area hospitals, you know. So that's kind of how that works.
And then we have the Children's Crisis Intervention Service via Telecare. Telecare provides crisis intervention services to minors who are placed on a 5150 and transported to the 5150 receiving center at the Behavioral Health Center.
Right. And so that same thing is kind of, it's just geared towards children or under 18, but the same sort of process where they're evaluated. Typically, a hold has already been written. A child or a minor cannot present, or they can't just come over to the psychiatric health facility and self-present. An adult can do that. An adult can just go and voluntarily go and say, I'm concerned, I feel like I'm at a risk to myself or risk to other people, and I feel like I need some additional support, and they can go in and be evaluated directly. Kids basically have to either go through one of the emergency departments, either Watsonville or Dominican, and or if they're brought in on a hold written by typically by law enforcement. Some of that's going to change, and I'll talk about that in a minute. So,
is it at the old Dominican Behavioral?
No.
So that's good. Is it back there in the same area?
No. So that good information. So so basically, I should know the address, and I don't. Somebody knows it right off the top.
It's in the 2000 block.
Yes.
2250
What? 2250 SoCo Ave. For those of you who've lived here a while, it's over near the old EDD across from Harbor High. It was where Otterello used to be. I don't know if anybody remembers.
So the younger people go there too?
Initially, they would go there. So okay. In Santa Cruz County, we don't have any inpatient care for minors.
Oh.
So they're always going to go out of the county. You know, different people have entertained having inpatient facilities here, but that's never really panned out. You know. Okay, and then subacute services. So subacute services definitely kind of includes a couple. It includes the two Davids here and their programs, and that is Telos, and I'll let David talk about that when it's his shot to kind of talk more about Telos, particularly in El Dorado Center, and then also what we call enhanced support services, which is also a subacute care support system, and this is provided by Encompass also, the Encompass organization. Entity, and these are ESS or enhanced support services is typically for clients that are already in the county system, they're already consumers there, and then if they're really having great difficulty, their coordinator, if you have someone that's involved in this way and you know that they have a coordinator, they can get enhanced support services, which is additional support services that can come into the home, the community, and kind of provide additional support. I do want to mention that all these systems they're impacted in different ways. You know, sometimes it's an easy service to connect to, and other times it's not. And I just want to be really honest and candid about that, you know. The other thing I just kind of want to talk about as far as pre-hospitalization or those sort of things. I brought a handout tonight. I don't think I made enough of them. It's called Tips for Handling a Crisis, and it was out there on the table. But I just want to, I think it's really important to mention in-home strategies, you know, and I'm not going to go do a training about that because I think NAMI does that in large degrees, you know, but I just want to highlight the importance of in-home strategies, of finding ways to support and sustain a stress-free environment as much as possible, not only for all of yourselves and your support systems, you know, but also with whoever you have in your family who's having a difficult time. Because the more you can kind of keep an equilibrium there, I think the better off everyone's going to be. I'm not suggesting that you just let all heck break loose and you just sit there and don't do anything. You can set boundaries within all that, but to you want to be, try to stay calm, equanimous, find strategies to kind of, for self-care and those sort of things. So this handout that I brought kind of addresses some communication styles, and I guess I'm assuming that Naomi teaches a lot of those things. But this was a particular one that I liked in my web search, so I brought it. So, and then we have the next, and then kind of post-hospitalization, typically, we have extended lock care. So we don't have a whole lot of people in extended lock care, because generally the philosophy is that we're really looking for least restrictive setting as much as possible. I'm really, especially with my background in children, I really have a high, I mean, generally with kids in general, I think most of them don't need to be hospitalized. I know it's a little bit different in the adult world. I mean, the percentage is different. But I think that ideally the best place for people to be is in the least restrictive environment as possible to not violate their rights, hopefully. But if we need to do that to protect themselves, to protect others, then that's what we need to do. Yeah. But barring that, definitely we're supporting the least restrictive environment. But we have 7th Avenue, which is here in town, and we have a few people through the county that are there. And then we have Crestwood, which is more long-term lock care, extended lock care. And then the other place, and it used to be, back in the old days, it used to be Napa State Hospital. People probably have heard of that. Santa Cruz no longer uses Napa State Hospital. Our go-to place is Metropolitan Hospital down in Los Angeles. And currently, we don't have anyone down there. You know, it's a long-term lock care for people that are just really having a difficulty staying in control and being safe. So that's available. And then we also kind of contract out with other kind of other subacute beds for long-term care, but typically they're not locked. So I just wanted to kind of mention that. And let's see if I can. So let's go to the next slide. So here, so briefly what happens, and some folks might already know this, is that basically, so initially, if there's kind of an acute crisis which involves law enforcement or the family or the individual, the consumer, feeling like they need some additional support or help, or they're really at high risk, they're in an acute distress, you know. So two ways you can kind of get to the CSP, which is the evaluation center, is either voluntarily or through a 5150. And people, I'm assuming people basically know what a 5150 is. Sort of good. So you go there, and then sometimes what happens is you go to the evaluation center, you go to the CSP, and the decision is not to hospitalize you, you know. So the choices are you can either go back home with some kind of hopefully support and some natural supports and good environment there, and usually with some typically with some other kind of follow-up, either with case management if you're a county consumer, or medicine if that's involved or important. Then you can also go from the CSP to EDC or Telos, which are the subacute facilities. So that would be, instead of going to the hospital, you would go to one of these places. And again, I'll let these other gentlemen talk about that. You could also go to inpatient care, which is the BHU, which is right there, it's on site, it's the same place. You could go to Second Story as an alternative, which is a peer-run respite place. Or sometimes people also go to the shelter. And when I first took this job, I was surprised. I mean, I was in a meeting, and all of a sudden somebody told me they were talking about the homeless population in this county. And I was surprised to hear that on any given day, the population of the homeless in Santa Cruz County is anywhere from 2,000 to 3,000 people. And I was, personally, I was really surprised by that number. I didn't think it was that high. I thought it was a tad less than that. But it was like, it's really a significant thing. And this is kind of a significant issue in general with people that have mental illness or a brain disorder, and they're also homeless. You know, that's really a difficult situation. So we're often in the place of kind of trying to bolster those people up and provide the best we can for them. And I think that's all I'm going to, except I want to kind of just briefly before I pass the baton, I want to kind of just talk about other things, updates from the county, if people don't know about them. We have police liaisons. Are people familiar with that or know that we do that now? So we currently have three embedded mental health professionals working with the three different jurisdictions. So we have James Russell with Santa Cruz Sheriff's Office. We have Danielle Long with Santa Cruz PD. And we have Reyna Valencia with Watsonville PD. And that's just brand new. So this is a really cool thing. And I can tell you that it has really diminished the amount of holes that have been written sometimes. It's improved the care on the street. It's improved just organically by police working side by side with mental health professionals. It's really began to shift things, and I'm really happy about that. If you were really ever curious about this, the cutting edge people on this is Berkeley. They've been doing it since the 70s, you know, which I was kind of really amazed at. So there, when you're a police officer in Berkeley, it's just kind of standard fare that you're going to be coupled up with mental health sometimes, you know. Whereas here, it's still a little bit of a new marriage, you know. So we are right about to start up a 28-hour CIT crisis intervention training for all law enforcement in Santa Cruz County, too. So specifically teaching them strategies about... teaching them strategies about kind of approaching, de-escalating, managing people, finding the right language, posture. There's all kinds of things that people need to be a little educated about, and if you're just a little smart about it, then it goes a lot better. We also I want to tell from our directors that we have a priority to expand supported housing beds next fiscal year, so we're wanting to create more housing, supported housing. And more. We also are in actively in discussion with Beacon, which is a mental health provider under Medi-Cal. We're more coordination, collaboration with Beacon and IBH, which is an integrated behavioral health clinic on the Emmeline campus, working with the medical clinic there and really trying to do a kind of a full range of care, so we're not just the county people say, no, you can't, you don't meet criteria, that if you don't meet criteria to come into 1400, that we can kind of find other places for you to go. So we really want to be more welcoming and be navigators to kind of connect people to all levels of care, you know. And then also the new thing, which I've really been hired and integrally involved in, is that we're going to be starting a children's walk-in service. We've never had this in Santa Cruz County. We're right on the threshold of, we're literally about a month away from doing that. We'll have a mobile response team for adults and kids both, which is about to roll out. The other cool thing about that, and specifically around the kids and stuff, is it's going to be payer source blind. What that means is that we will take whatever your insurance is or not insurance, we will take you in and we'll do an evaluation, we'll help you in an acute situation. And then, for instance, if you have a private insurance, instead of just kind of perhaps like having you look on the back of the card and say, just call this number, we're going to try to help you call the number and maybe connect you with somebody and find, make some recommendations around that, as opposed to just kind of giving you a number to call. And then the long-range vision is for that to be community-based. It's actually going to, the walk-in center for kids in particular will eventually leave the Emmeline campus. It'll be much more community-based out in the community on the bus line and much more kind of community-friendly, you know, and kind of more kid-friendly, not kind of the old school county compound of Emmeline, you know, kind of stepping back into the 50s there. And then the other thing is we have a psychologist who is a county hired person, but they're fully credentialed at the emergency department at Dominican, and they're helping and they're evaluating when kids come in on 5150 hold, and they're helping with that situation, because before sometimes we were having a lot of people being hospitalized because there wasn't really the high expertise there, I mean, back a bunch of years ago. So, and I think that's it, and I'm going to hand it off to David.
We're very organized. I think Adrian.
Sorry. I'm sorry. I didn't follow my outline that I wrote. Adrian's.
Hello, everybody. I'm going to find my breathing room and space, so I think The light is now on. So I just want to say, just to open, just to welcome to everybody, and to just to, you know, just to recognize what has brought us here, and it means, it usually means a lot of, can mean a lot of pain and a lot of disorder and a lot of chaos, but it also can mean a lot of grounded energy and connectedness that we all share through this pain. And so, to really just take a moment to recognize what brings us here in this room, and how big it can be, and how we have to stand together to create change around it and within it and through it. So we're here. I'm part of a second story, and that's a peer-run respite house. And so when we started the program 5 years ago, we were number seven in the United States, and now there's 26 or more and growing. Still, the second story, the respite house model is growing. It's run by peers, which is basically people who have gone through the mental health system. And you know, I've myself been hospitalized 6 times, I think, two weeks apiece, and just kind of gone through a lot of really, really difficult voices and paranoia and all this stuff that really, I don't know where it comes from, but it's here. So so I think that we're sort of the flagship of the world, really, in a lot of ways. Second story is, we got a grant through SAMHSA, and it was the county that applied for the grant, and we've been mentored in this process of what it means to run a program like this, and five years now, here we are, able to really grow within Encompass as a part of the Encompass family, and sort of the grant was written as a transformation grant, and so the idea is that we work within the system so that we can transform and make it, and bring peers more to the core of complete service or care or whatever we want to call it. That we're a part of the system now, and we're growing within it, and change is happening as a result of the interface between peers and providers. So that's really a kind of a wonderful kind of approach to what it means to be a part of this provider and family and peer community. So we allow up to 6 people can stay with us, so 6 people can stay with us at a time. We're currently at 211 Stanford Avenue, and we've just applied for a grant that I'm certain we're going to get this grant. We're going to be able to buy a home, so allow permanency for a second story as a program. There's also, why do people say so much when they talk? I wonder. So what we offer is a place where people can, it's basically a respite house, which means people can get away from the impending chaos. If chaos is on the way, we kind of know people, they know what's going on. We expect that people know what's going on in their lives enough to be able to address it right before it starts to happen. So if people are having a difficult time, they give us a call, they have an interview. It's usually called a proactive interview. We just call it a conversation, really. It's a conversation that lasts about 30 or 45 minutes, and then the person is able to usually get in. Usually it's a pretty green light for most people. So unless the red lights are system of care, it's a red light, but it's also a green light, because people who are system of care receiving services up at Building K, the Emmeline building, are eligible for our program. People who are also have housing, that can be couch surfing. If people are couch surfing, we won't look the other way, but we'll accept that people have a stable place or a somewhat stable place. We're not going to go in through any like rigorous kind of process to name whether a person's actually eligible. You know, in that sense, with housing, it's not such a strict thing. You can be someone that has a place at the shelter or at places like the loft or friends and family members. As long as you have a place to go back to, you can stay with us. But again, you go back to the system of care, being a part of the Building K system of services and care. That's what we have to work with folks that are. That's what and our current funding comes from the county. So we're working directly with folks that are receiving the most services, and in a sense, trying to break people free of the services, sort of, because of the model that we offer around communication, collaboration, around respect, around. I think empowerment's a big part of it. I think I'm getting ahead of myself, but so as I said, we all at the house have gone through the system, or gone through very difficult times enough to qualify as a peer. And a peer is someone that has gone through it and been there. And the idea is that people who have gone through it and have been through it usually know how. I don't say better. It's not better. It's not worse. But have a way of connecting that sort of lessens it lessens the stigma, lessens the really the oppression that can happen because of these, because of what we all share, the shared mental health experience. So, and I can give a basic, there's no real rules in our program. There's no real kind of, you have to do this, you have to do that. There's a constant match. Like, I can give an example. For a while, there was a debate about curfews and whether we should have a curfew or not. And it was tough, and I'm sitting here staunch, and I'm just saying, we're not going to have a curfew because what we need to have is, because people were going out in the middle of the night, coming back at 4 in the morning, sleeping all day, going back out at night. So it gets to be, okay, what's really going on here for the person? And we start looking for the untold story. And how do we navigate these extreme states? So the dialogue around the curfew was, we need a curfew because we need to have force. We need to make sure people are here. They're using our service. And it's like, no. We're built on communication. We're built on trust the best we can. And people are going to fall. So it becomes, we want to talk to people about what's going on. We don't want to anticipate that they're out there using drugs. We want to anticipate that they're wanting to be in a relationship in some way. And so just an example of what it's like in the house, and as people come in, there's not really mental illness present in our home. I mean, there's people going through extreme difficulties. There's not biological brain disease that I'm talking to on the other end of my biological brain disease. It's actually a human connection. It feels like the moment people walk in, I can't remember the last time mental illness was brought up in our home. I can't remember the last time we talked about bipolar disorder or schizophrenia, other than just kind of speaking to, God, does it feel good to be called these things? And what's it like to have to be locked up? And what is it like to go through big states without saying, well, that's a bipolar disorder state, manic breakdown, that's what that is. It's more like, we're just kind of navigating this space of trust and openness and collaboration and connection that defies a lot of the traditional ways of viewing what it is that we go through as a community and what we drag all of you into with us. Because we do that too. And I feel like I'll be making amends for that for a long time with my own family, with families here, and that we don't recognize that it is a shared phenomenon. So I think that outside of all that, it tends to be a just trying to think of kind of the rules and the guidelines. Some rules that we have are would be something like no weapons, no clubs, no fighting, no sexual misconduct, no things, just basic stuff like that. We call them guidelines, not even rules, because we don't want rules to control the day. We have probably too few many groups. We have probably too few many groups my suspicion is that people ask for groups. I think they ask for groups so they don't have to go to groups. I'm not sure. But we do offer groups, and people don't necessarily want to go to groups. We have them throughout the day. They're pretty. It's a pretty kind of a. It's kind of like a, I would say it's a kind of a loose kind of place to just let go of energy, to be free with people who aren't going to assess or judge or say this is this and that is that. I don't think we read Dr. Seuss books or anything like that. I had said this is this and that is that. It's like a for some reason, but we have. I'm just so happy to be a part of the Second Story community, and it really means a lot to me to have spent 5 years working there and still continuing forward to be there from the very beginning and watch it grow and flourish, and now it's finally starting to take root, and it's pretty incredible. It's a pretty incredible space of trust and humility and gentleness, and it's really wonderful in that sense. And it gets wild, it gets crazy at times. I like the word crazy, I hope it doesn't offend anybody. But that's okay too. It's just an experience. And I think that so the future of it now is something that's really immersed in Encompass right now, and we receive training from Encompass. So we got mindfulness trainings, and we get trauma informed care trainings, and we get motivational interviewing trainings, and we incorporate all of these ways into our program, into our home, so that we have the best way of serving folks with the best kind of the top of the line skills of being able to articulate, communicate. We also have something called intentional peer support, where we all learn together. We all train together. Everybody in the house will be trained if they aren't already. And so we basically, it's a way of communicating, you know, of honoring the first, where people, let's see, it first starts off with connection. Starts off with connection, then moves towards worldview, then goes to mutuality, then it goes to moving towards. So these are kind of the four steps along the way. And I might have mixed two and three, but I'm foggy and I've got 30 seconds left. So we have a lot of experience of how to communicate with folks and how to bring people into a community that is growing and getting stronger, and people that really care about each other in a way that nourishes our community, the community of Santa Cruz, the community of the United States, across the United States, where peer respites are starting to grow and hopefully starting to flourish like some of ours have been. And so it's the opportunity here is to start incorporating all of us. And so it's providers have been running the show and legitimately and doing it in the way that the best they can, family members as well. And so now peers are starting to step into it. And now how do we all speak the common ground language that we all share so that we can understand each other, relate to each other, and says, you know, we have different perspectives and different personas, but we are all in this together. We really are in this together. And so it's just, and so my commitment is to that higher calling to all of us in Santa Cruz right now, and how we can flourish this mental health community. And I'll stop there.
Hi everyone, I'm David Campbell and I'm the program manager at the El Dorado Center. I just want to start off by saying thank you for so much for allowing me to be here today and present to you. I've worked at the El Dorado Center for 5 years now, and I've worked with Encompass for 10 years now. Total, I've worked in mental health about 12 years, and I wanted to start off by sharing a personal story of mine. Before I started working in mental health and decided to go into psychology, I was on a break home from school, and my dad started to tell me a story about how he grew up. And it, like, something unlocked for him that he had never realized before. It was at that point he came to the realization, like, he grew up with a mother that had schizophrenia. And hearing him tell this story to me really hit me. And I decided that's what I need to do. Like, I want to work with families and individuals who are struggling with their own experience with mental health. And so that's been my heart and passion. And I want to share that with you because I understand the individuals that come to El Dorado Center. I mean, devastated by loss and trauma and how hard of a struggle it can be for the families of individuals struggling with mental health issues. So with that, El Dorado Center. So we're a 16-bed residential treatment program. We're a short-term program. Average length of stay for individuals that go to EDC is between 25 and 30 days. On average, some people maybe stay way less, maybe 2 or 3 days. Some people stay months, depending on their life situation, their situation with their mental health issues, and where their plan is, where they go, what's their discharge plan. Our main referral sources, so individuals, how they get to El Dorado Center. Our main referral source is the Crisis Stabilization Program and the Santa Cruz Psychiatric Health Facility, which Marty mentioned. So about 70% of our referrals come from some sort of locked facility or locked placement. And that's part of our ultimate goal, is we want to help individuals make that transition back into their lives. So stepping down from locked care, whether it's in a long-term locked facility, at the CSP, at the PUF, in jail, we really want to help people make that transition, have a safe, comfortable place to make the transition back into their lives. By the way, if you didn't get our handout, it's up here on the table. About half of the people that we serve end up discharging back home, back to their own apartment, living independently in some way. At the El Dorado Center, when an individual gets there, we really pride ourselves on being open and flexible with people, trying to provide individual treatment plans, allowing the family to be, like, fully inviting the family to be involved, and collaborating with the other partners that the person may be working with. We really strive to be client-centered and to give the people that come to EDC a voice in their treatment. There might be a perception that when people come to El Dorado Center that, or other places, other mental health programs, that medications are required. And that's certainly not true for EDC. We want to give people a choice and facilitate them having a voice and them giving direction to what's best for them. It does happen that we do get people, and people are off meds at El Dorado Center. And we're open to that. We want to treat people as individuals and provide them a safe, comfortable place to make choices about what's going to facilitate their wellness best. So a little bit more about EDC, the services that we provide. So every resident that is referred to EDC, so they're assigned a 1-1 counselor at EDC, and that's their point person that will work with them individually on their treatment goals, what they want to work towards, what are their goals while they're in the program, and what where they might leave the program and discharge to. We also have an on-site psychiatrist. It's an assigned county psychiatrist, but every individual that comes into our program has the opportunity to work with a psychiatrist, see a psychiatrist daily if necessary. We also have a nurse on our staff, our resident nurse, so she helps facilitate people connecting to their primary care physician and following up on important medical appointments, addressing dental needs. So she's really vital to our program. She also offers a weekly group based on health and wellness. And that's another large part of our program is providing groups while people are at EDC. We don't like to say that groups are mandatory. We like to give people the option, and we try to provide a variety of options to engage people while they're there in different areas of health and wellness. So we have art groups, music groups, journaling groups. We also provide a variety of movement groups. So every morning we do like stretching, some kind of movement in the morning to music. We do walks. We also have a mindfulness yoga group at the program, which people are very, very engaged in and people find very helpful. So we just try to engage people in a variety of ways while they're there, with the groups, with the individual counseling. We are 24-hour staffed programs, so there's staff there 24 hours a day. And as far as what the treatment looks like while they're there and where people go, it's really dependent on their life situation. Like I said, about half of the people that we serve go to their own home, back home with a family, to their own apartment. Other individuals might be referred to another program. They may go to a substance use program. If the people are in the board, county mental health system, and we're very connected to all the board and cares in the county. So that's one of the other, really one of the own real requirements of individuals for when they come to the El Dorado Center is they have to be involved in the county mental health system in some way. So which would mean they would probably be assigned a county case coordinator. So I would strongly advocate for individuals if you know someone or one of your family members ends up at one of the locked facilities or in their community and they're connected to case manager, like use what you can to advocate for the individual to get into treatment. Not a lot of people are aware of the CSP or the PUF, maybe if someone were happen to end up there, that you can advocate with the staff over there to make that referral possible. That resource is there. Not a lot of people are aware of that, you know, so talk to the social workers there, you know. So that's one of my recommendations that we're out there to help people. We rarely turn down any referrals if the referral comes our way. Our automatic assumption when people are referred to us is it's a yes. It's a yes. We rarely turn down an individual who wants to come. Most of the time, if a person became a referral to us, one of the main reasons they would come is if the individual's not interested in coming to us. So I think that's all I have, and I really appreciate the time. I will turn it over to David McBride.
Stand over here and balance out the room a little bit.
I want you folks to feel left out.
Thanks for being here, and thanks for having me. It's a real honor to talk to you all. Special thanks to Carol for inviting me and having me. And to all the people in this room, I mean, it's a tough act to follow these two, so I'll do my best. But to all the folks that are struggling with their loved ones or in programs or policymakers or other providers in the community to provide sort of a safety net and whether you call it recovery or healing work to help people as individuals and as part of the community to reconnect somehow. I got so much I could say about Telos. Not Telos, Marty. We need not go back and forth about this. Telos.
Everybody calls it different things.
We call it Telos. I have a lot to say, and I'm not even sure exactly what you want to know. And there's some little bullet points in here I'm supposed to follow. Length of stay and structure. I'll give you some nuts and bolts. We're a 10-bed hospital diversion program. So our main mission, the reason we were created back in 2008, was to offer an alternative to 5150. There's other programs that are stepped down from the hospital. We were designed to offer people a viable alternative when they're in, just speaking, you know, Marty mentioned language and Adrian talked about it too, you know, what to call it. We were called the crisis house for a long time, you know. Some people call it extreme states. Some people call it awakenings. There's all kinds of language that's used. Some people talk about brain disorders and schizophrenia. Some people talk about other neurobiological phenomena. And we try to be really extra careful with our language as well and really help people own the language that they use to talk about their experiences and themselves. So we're neither pro-brain disease nor anti-brain disease, and we're neither pro-mental health labels nor anti-mental health labels, and we're neither pro-med nor anti-med. We want to help people make important decisions for themselves. And our name, Telos, it's from the Greek. Telos is the movement of something to its perfected end state. So like the telos of an acorn is an oak tree. What's the telos of a human being? I mean, who can say? It's not for us to say. We want to help people discover that for themselves and get on that path and name it for themselves. So we do have, you know, and because we're the highest level of care, unlocked care, excuse me, in the county, when we opened, we knew we're really going to need to offer something different to folks, something besides just treatment as usual. And that's not any kind of diss on treatment as usual. It was us wondering, what does it take to hold individuals in a community in an unlocked setting for people that are really going through intense internal states? The kind of states that others are saying, we have to send you away somewhere. And that's done out of love and caring. How can we hold a community of folks when even in the program they're doing things that are disturbing the community? Not intentionally. Things like yelling. Yelling disturbs the community. But people harming themselves and somehow burning or cutting or doing these sorts of things are people who have a lot at stake. Life and death is on the line for a lot of folks that come into the program. How can we hold that without being another place that sends people away? So we struggle with that all the time. And we based the program, for a while, you know, we didn't have any structure. You're supposed to have structure in a program. You got to have some structure. And we just kind of wonder, who says you have to have structure when you're not well? When you're going through, or maybe you're on the verge of extreme wellness, but it looks like a crisis from one angle. So we base the program on two things, and we still do. One-on-one contact and relationship, and the use of the community itself to both hold people and to dialogue together about what is happening with all of the individuals, not just like the clients and the staff, all of us. What's happening with us in the context of others, other people's suffering? So that's a little bit general, a little bit vague. I don't know how to make it more specific without boring you all with more nuts and bolts of like, okay, you know, we do have an average length of stay. Oh, a couple other things. We're also the only program where people that aren't in the system can come. So about 30% of the folks that we serve aren't connected to county mental health. These could be folks that are in the homeless community that are showing up and only have access to emergency services. So they touch at emergency services and they go back. And so we offer folks a viable alternative there too. And we've seen a pattern for a lot of people over the last 8 years of folks that used to go to, say, a hospital pattern can start doing a Telos pattern, which also, that's not the end state either, but they can, it's a gradual building on somebody kind of, I don't know what word to put on it, but being able to grapple with and assimilate and bring meaning to internal states that initially have no meaning. But folks, it is a short-term program, and that's by design. Average length of stay is about 10 days. The maximum is 30. Part of the design of that is because, like Marty said, the system is so impacted, we've got to get some flow. Because if we hold on to folks, that means people are going to locked care. But also, we want to support people in connecting somehow, even if it's a tenuous connection, and being able to go back home or go back wherever folks came from. We also, folks once can step down from Telos to El Dorado or to Second Story. What am I leaving out? What should I say here? Oh, the general rules. There's a lot of alignment with Second Story and Telos. You know, we used to, our fantasy that we used to say to ourselves, we don't have any rules. It wasn't true. But that was our mantra, to remember we have to get out of all of this structure and rules overlay on people, because then we become a bunch of rule enforcers, and that's not our function, is to enforce rules with people. It's also part of our belief that even when people are in intense places, there's still a locus of control and there's still an ability to articulate things and work things out and make decisions. And a big part of our work with folks in the spirit of language is we listen to the language of people's, what are normally called symptoms. We listen to that language, and we believe and we help people discover what's the meaning in the symptom. Or if people are speaking in ways that, hello, that meant something. If people are speaking in ways that sound like, oh, that doesn't make any sense, or that's psychotic, or that's delusional, and maybe it is all those things. I'm open to that too. But it's still, it's embedded in meaning. And it's our work to help to learn people's language and talk to them within their own language first, instead of insisting that people who are suffering come speak our language first. So it's like a bridge that we have to build to them. We offer groups now. We have a really fantastic group therapist. We also try to offer groups that are also not groups that are more common in other places, like psychoeducation groups and skill building groups. We're not down with that specifically. So we have more in the moment process groups with people, and we find that even folks who are disconnected and have a hard time interacting can come in and join that group in their own way and find a way to be an active member of a community rather than just an isolated person who can't join a community or a group. And we try to do things with expressive arts and helping people access their bodies, movement, mindfulness that these guys alluded to. So we do have some rules. And we help people grapple with how, when, whatever community they're going to, how they can not only be connected to the people in their lives, but grapple with the rules of the places wherever they have to go. And we find that there's people really, really take to that, and they begin to be able to make decisions about how do I deal with other people's rules or community rules that I don't like, or that I want to thumb my nose at, or that I think are BS or something. What else? I think that might be about it. Let me think if I left anything out. It's amazing to me that, and there's one more thing, I've noticed over the years that for some reason, when people come into Telos, they very commonly don't do the things that seem to be getting them, running them afoul of their communities wherever they come from. I don't understand it. I'm tempted to say it's magic, but I'm not sure if that's it. It's something magical, though. I think about Carl Jung said, this is an exact quote, but it's the gist of it. When somebody who is schizophrenic is understood, they cease to be schizophrenic. So there's something about the in being heard in your own language and being with somebody in a reflective space. It's medicine right there. It's not magic. It's not like people walk out and say, I'm never going to be unwell again. But it's a start, and it shows us, it tells me, and it tells us, a lot of the folks that tell us, we talk about it all the time, like, you know, maybe it's possible that people never need to be locked up. Maybe it's possible that there's ways to help people heal and grow and change without the need for coercion or being locked up. Just like we want to help people, and I want to support all of you in questioning for yourselves and helping the folks that you love and serve question, what's the wellness or healing path for me? Is it meds or not? Is it program or not? Is it, what is it? And help people understand not only to make that choice, but how to do the work of moving on that path. I think that's it. Yeah.
My name is Keisha, and I'm here with my business partner, Sean Smith, and we're very grateful to Cheryl for initially reaching out to us and Carol for inviting us to speak tonight. So I just wanted to say thank you. This is a really exciting opportunity for me because Coastal Turning Point, the treatment center that Sean and I created, has been a lifelong dream for me. Like many of you, my life has been touched by family members who struggle with mental illness and substance abuse. And when I met Sean about 4 years ago, I had a very strong sense that he was the one who was supposed to help me, like, bring this vision to life. And we've had a lot of fun putting it all together. We opened our doors in October of 2014. And our goal was to provide behavioral health treatment in a real integrated, holistic model. We wanted to support people in many different ways, so we created several different levels of care. Our primary start was with just simple outpatient counseling and treatment in just the traditional once-a-week counseling and outpatient modality. And then we started our intensive outpatient program. And as the calls started to come in for the intensive outpatient program, which we thought would be designed for those with dual diagnosis, we quickly realized the need in Santa Cruz County for a mental health intensive outpatient program, you know, as a track by itself. So we extended our program and branched out to create a mental health track and a substance abuse track. And we also have a teen intensive outpatient program. And the intensive outpatient level of care is three groups a week, and each group is 3 hours a day. We are starting our partial hospitalization, which is an intensive day treatment program, and that's going to be starting mid-April. And that's for, you know, the purpose of all of these programs, and the reason why we are invited here today is because Coastal Turning Point really provides an option for those people coming out of inpatient level of care, and also as a preventative measure for those people with less severe symptoms to hopefully avoid hospitalization. And so Sean's going to talk in more detail about some of our program features and that kind of thing.
Yeah, I'd just like to follow up with what Keisha said about thanking everybody for having us and giving us an opportunity to talk a little bit about our program. So some of the features of the program have been developed as a kind of a result of Keisha and I taking a look at treatment as it, having worked in treatment of different forms since 2000. And two, in Keisha, nearly about that same amount of time, just seeing a lot of the places where I felt like treatment was breaking down for the client, particularly in the transitioning from a residential to outpatient, and then from outpatient to kind of just community support. It just seemed to be very fast, and it felt like people were walking out of residential and, you know, being provided with a couple of groups a week or whatever, it's a lot different, a lot less, the support feels much, much different than when you're in a 24-hour-a-day facility. So we started looking at some of that and developing the program to kind of address some of those needs. So, I mean, just like a lot of programs, we're, of course, doing individualized treatment, really working on focusing on what the client wants, what the individual wants from treatment, and what they want to get out of it. Whereas one of the things that we noticed with a lot of programs is that groups would be upwards of 20 people to a group and really didn't feel like anybody was getting any kind of individual attention at the group level. So we kind of committed early on to never have more than 8 people in a group. Not just looking at for people who are coming into maybe that's like the substance abuse track, not just looking at substance abuse issues, but really kind of like drilling down and finding out what's really going on with the individual that's like causing that in the first place. So we offer bio and neurofeedback. Both Keisha and I, as well as another facilitator at Coastal Turning Point, are trained in EMDR, which is good for dealing and treating trauma. We do family therapy. We are not a, you know, for any, whether it's the mental health track or the substance abuse track, not a one size fits all. So people coming in, they're not going to get the typical, like, just, you know, go to a meeting and get a sponsor and do that. You know, it's going to be like much more supportive and really kind of like offering a bunch of options to people. I feel like when people are given, when they're told what to go do, it's not very effective. But when I have like a choice of a number of things to do, it seems more palatable and easy to kind of choose one for myself. So relapse prevention, of course, is important in providing the support to the support and the tools to prevent relapse, assessment and evaluation, parent education, both for the for the clients who maybe have kids, teaching parenting skills, but also for the family members. All three of the programs have a family component, so the families are invited in to get some services with the individual in the program. But also we also offer a family support group that's, for just people in the community who, parents in the community who are struggling with raising their child for whatever reason. And then also people from our group do have their parents, or if they're a parent, do attend that as well. We offer Brain Resource, which is a brain health assessment and provides tools for improving brain health. Aftercare parent coaching, flexible hours and group times. So we have, you know, groups in the afternoon, we have groups in the evening, and we just started as of probably next week a group at from 9 to 12. So we have AM groups, PM groups, and evening groups. And then I wanted to get back to continuous support. So when we kind of looked at or talked about opening the center and what kind of a program we wanted to present to people, really kind of wanted to model it after kind of a continuous recovery model that was happening in Santa Clara County right as I was transitioning out. And it was really so people don't have the headache of, you know, if you've ever been to a program and then you discharge from that program and maybe something happens and you need their services again, you've got to go back and you've got to fill out all of that paperwork again. You have to go through that whole process again. Sometimes, like, you have to meet a new clinician and start working with somebody new again. And we really felt like, you know, why is that necessary? Why not try and keep people as tied into their clinician throughout the whole process as possible? And let's not make it a, okay, you're discharging now, you're transitioning, you don't need our, you don't need as much support as you once did. So maybe where you needed 9 hours a group a week, now you don't need any group a week, and you just need to see, maybe get a little bit of support from a clinician, or maybe you don't need any support at all, and we just kind of part ways for a while, but then you do need, something happens and you do need support and you come back, you're not going to be handed a fistful of paperwork and made to go through that whole process again. We can kind of work with people and keep that going. We'll do another assessment just to see where they're at, but not have the whole process start all over again. So again, just allows for seamless transitions. It doesn't, takes away that sudden reduction of support. So if somebody's coming from residential and they go into the partial program, or goes from partial to the outpatient program, there's going to be support there, and when they're ready to step down, they don't have to step down from, you know, 9 hours a group a week, or, you know, 7 times 5, 35 hours a group a week, or 35 hours of support a week to 9 hours of support. We can kind of build it in so where we can have them checking in on a daily basis. We can have them doing, rather than doing 9 hours a group, 3 hours a group 3 times a week, maybe doing 1 3-hour group a week. So we can really tailor the care and meet the individual what they need and support they need at any given time, raising and lowering that level of care as we go. I have slides about that continuous care. You can tell I'm proud of that. So who's appropriate for our program? What the ILP and pre-PH group program serves substance use disorders, major depression, bipolar disorder, panic disorders, generalized anxiety, obsessive-compulsive disorders, as well as other challenging conditions. So somebody asked the other day, like, what is the exclusionary criteria for Coastal Turning Point? And, you know, I think we're just kind of saying yes at this point. So, you know, obviously if somebody's not going to benefit from the group or the service, then they need a higher level of care. If somebody is imminently suicidal, they probably need a higher level of care. But if we can work with somebody who is in any one of those states with, you know, maybe in combination with support from the family or whatever it takes to keep people out of locked facilities, that's what we're doing. So some of the group topics for both tracks, substance abuse, a little bit more on the CBT end of things. Healthy relationships, life skills, self-care, creating a supportive network, do a lot of work around the relapse prevention skills, and emotional regulation. And then for the mental health track, doing a lot of CBT skills, not the classic CBT model, but the skills training piece of it, you know, teaching self-care, building esteem, building community, life skills, healthy relationships, and seeking safety, all models. I know for me, when I was struggling the most in my life, the thing that really saved me wasn't the 12-step program. It wasn't a clinician necessarily. It was really a sense of community, and that's what we're trying to build at Coastal Turning Point, just a community of people who are able to be there and support each other, and so far it's working fantastically.
So, Sean and I are really proud of our staff. You know, it's taken a little bit to get to the point where we feel like we've got the dream team, you know, kind of like how we pictured the whole thing to look. And so I, including us, because we are officially employees, there's, what, 8 of us now? And we have also a few other contracted therapists. And a really great group of folks. They're very skilled in many different types of modalities. We have people who can treat, you know, almost anything that people are coming in with, anything from like eating disorders to, you know, some serious mood disorders. And I'm really, really proud of the team. Most are master's level clinicians on the licensure track or licensed. And also we have some great substance abuse counselors on staff who do a fantastic job working with our clients. And so really proud of the staffing. Thank you for the time. The question everybody always asks, and we made a slide for it, is, you know, how do we pay for the program? And so our program is really a solution for those folks who have private insurance and can't access a lot of the county services. We do have a contract with Beacon Health Strategies, so for people who aren't able to access the county mental health services, a lot of times the Beacon Health Strategies picks up those folks, and we're able to provide individual counseling and psychiatry through our contract with Beacon Health Strategies. Psychiatry is offered through video conferencing, so not as great as you know, in person, but it is better than nothing for certain. And you know what, the psychiatrists that I've met through doing this process have actually been quite good, and the process is working really, really well. And also that people can receive other support at our center through individual counseling and groups. It's really working out good. We work with most insurance payers, and for the out-of-pocket expenses, oftentimes we can offer some scholarships or sliding scale. And obviously, in situations where people are uninsured or cash coming in as cash payers, we offer sliding scale and payment options for everybody. Right now, all of our intensive services are offered at our Santa Cruz location, which is expanding. In about 8 weeks, we're going to have about 1,600 more square feet, which is going to finally provide that opportunity for our partial hospitalization program. The day program is going to be a great step down for those coming from the inpatient level, or for those who don't necessarily need it inpatient, but just like that one step down from inpatient or residential level of care. In Scott Valley, we have another branch, and that's where we just do basic outpatient counseling. And so we serve a lot of people from the Valley, the Scotts Valley office. But we're right downtown, so it's very easy for most people from Santa Cruz County to access our facility. And that's it.
So now it's the question time. I guess since I stood up for... yes.
Yeah, what are your lead times? And are you all social houses? What is the lead time? If somebody shows up, how many days before they can actually go in?
Second story immediately. And if,
so I want to repeat the question so that he's asking, what's the lead time for second story? So
no,
somebody
the,
shows
for
up for all of them, how much time will it take to get fitted?
If a person calls us, they set up an appointment, they come over, then we have the conversation, and they can come in immediately. So it depends on if we have space or not. That's another question, and we can have a wait list at that point. But it, usually if we have space, then people can immediately enter. And then sober house is not, I don't think there's any way we could maintain a sober. And we believe in a more harm reduction kind of people. We can't control people using drugs. We allow... Like, if people want to go out and have a beer or something, that's okay. But if they come back trashed or something, then we're going to have a conversation at that point about not really the appropriate use of our services. And pot is legal in California, so we don't get medical marijuana cards. It's like, it's okay. Anything else is just, if we recognize it, we have a conversation with people. But we don't try and, we're more about building relationships than worrying about drugs and alcohol.
And I want to say one of the unique things about Second Story is that consumers self-refer.
Yes.
So it's different than other systems where it's a referral coming from a professional. It's a self-referral there. It's
so
really unique. Yeah.
Yes, sir.
Yeah.
So Telos is also, we're 24/7 access, depending on where somebody's coming from. And if we have a bed, a lot of times we don't, or there's a log jam somewhere, and it's a constant, it's a flaw in our system. It's impacted system. We're constantly trying to juggle and prioritize folks. So some folks that might need it might have to wait for somebody else that needs it more, depending on the circumstances.
How long is that wait?
Well, how long is a piece of string? It's hard to say. It could be. It depends on when. It could be 1 day. It could be 5 days before we have a discharge. I wish I could give you an exact amount, but we're immediate access when we have a bed. There's no wait. And as far as
So it could be no wait at all.
Yeah.
Or like David said, it could be 5 days or a week.
Yeah. And as far as like drugs and alcohol, I mean, we ask people to take a vacation from that while they're with us. Whatever their circumstances coming in, we ask people to put that aside so they can more readily try to wrestle with whatever's churning up inside of them. And we also know that people are going to end their vacation prematurely, so to speak, and they're going to engage with drugs or alcohol while they're with us. And we talk about that as individuals and as a community. But people aren't going to be ejected from the program if they do that. If it's some repeat thing or if somebody under the influence of something, you know, some people change in drastic ways. And we deal with that too. But yeah, that's how we handle it. We don't ever put anybody out on the streets, ever. No matter what they do. There's not a single thing they could do that we would do that.
For El Dorado Center, similar to Telus, it's hard to say when or what the wait list is like. If we have a bed, we take that person that day. It's hard to tell. It's a long jab system, so it's based on who has priority and where the referral is coming from. But if the referral happens that day and we have a bed, we usually accept the person that day. And usually our policy with substance use or misuse is we ask people to abstain while they're in the program. That's just our general policy. We rarely would ask someone to leave the first time. Sometimes relapse is a part of recovery, so we try to work with that individual on an individual basis what they can commit to while they're in the program. So that's really our policy. We don't have like a strike rule, or it's based on what the community can allow and what the person is willing to buy into while they're there.
So I want to say I have the difficult position of trying to prioritize sometimes, totally. And trying to look at acuity of people that need to come in and then helping people find other alternatives to move out. But I do want to say that the highest priority is to people that are in locked care. So those are the people that I'm most prioritizing. People that are ready to come out of locked care, they're really the highest priority. Yeah.
I would like to know whether or not the adult mental health program here in Santa Cruz County educates their psychiatrists and their therapists on the alternatives available to talk with their clients about. And I ask that question because I accompany for a small portion of each meeting the ill member of my family, and the psychiatrists and therapists have not been helpful at all. And basically, I'm told to have the adult in crisis go to the homeless shelter or take them to an emergency room and let the hospital, the system, take care of them. And I have been in crisis recently with the ex-significant other trying to help him, and the only people who were able to help me get pointed in the right direction was when I called the teachers of the NAMI program I'm involved with. Otherwise, there was no help, there was nothing. And it was so hard on me that the county mental health services, okay, these trained professionals, and I apologize, they really don't seem to give a shit, and they don't know. And I'm sorry, because I know it's your program and it's not meant as a reflection on you, but you can see how painful and terrible it is for those of us trying to help
Understood.
People.
Yeah.
That none of this, they share none of this with you.
Mm-hmm. So my heart goes out to you, first of all. And I mean, one of the things I do is I oversee the access team, which is, you know, I'm new to this whole thing. Kids is my kind of expertise, but anyway, on any given day, the amount of folks that come through that front door is just kind of mind-blowing to me. I mean, it really is. So the staff are kind of impacted with high crisis all the time. We have law enforcement rolling up several times a day. We've got all kinds of very acute crisis. And I'm not trying to be make an excuse for us. I think we could all do a better job. I think one of the areas where we're, and I'm actively working on this, is to be generally more welcoming and more informed in finding ways specifically to kind of help family members also and everybody and have other alternatives out there. Right now we're really understaffed. And again, I'm not trying to, we don't have enough therapists on board. We're it's like we have a significant hiring issue. And I know this personally because my mobile crisis team was supposed to roll out almost 9 months ago. And I've been struggling with just getting people on board. As far as the psychiatrist, I'm happy to talk with Vanessa De La Cruz, who's our chief psychiatrist, and kind of talk about what you brought up and kind of discussing other alternatives and educating them.
You know what would be wonderful is if your psychiatrists and your therapists could have this lady and these gentlemen come to Emmeline and sit down and give a presentation. So, I was required as a county employee to go to continuous education and to go to county training and everything. This is incredible.
So some of that has happened. I mean, just to let you know, I remember, I don't want to take too much time, but I remember going, I've just been so, swamped with kind of all the stuff that happens. I remember going over a second story and going, "Guy, I want to stay here." I'm sincere, and I even thought I got to get back over there. And I literally got so overwhelmed in my day-to-day tasks that I haven't done that. But there is some really good things.
And this isn't directed at you personally.
Oh no, I get that.
It's just very painful and very emotional.
Understood.
And it came out that way.
So we do in-service trainings. We do bring peer panels on board. We do those things. Yes.
Excuse me.
Sorry.
Excuse me. Thank you for saying that and for putting all that out there. I'm sorry that happened, and it's very painful. Thank you for saying that.
You'll be next. Yes.
I just wanted to make maybe a recommendation. Just kind of came to my mind right now. I'm interested in becoming a peer advocate, and maybe there were a few, 4 or 5 peer advocates that could be around that kind of area, and when somebody is kind of in crisis and having a hard time, there would be people that have other information that's available, and kind of all of this stuff available to them, so they don't feel like there's just one place to go and that's it, and if you don't get in, you don't get in, because there are, look at all this, we have a lot to offer.
I think coupling peer advocates with the front door is a really good idea. I mean, I'm sincere in that. I really think that's a good idea. Yes?
My question is about insurance. So when my daughter's business started, County Mental Health did not have anything to offer because we had insurance. Mm-hmm. But then there was a whole lot of expensive treatment, and the insurance didn't pay for any of it. So it would be really helpful if each of you would be willing to tell which of these programs do you have to be on, what source of funding. And then someone mentioned Beacon, and I've never heard of Beacon, but I'd really like to know how you pay for these services. Because it seems like with insurance, you're funded out a lot of stuff, a lot of really, really good stuff, but then insurance will,
I would like to second that.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah, okay. There are no services like you guys are offering for people who are in pain.
Well, actually, I don't know.
I think that, this is, part of the unmet need that Sean and I are trying to address. And in the beginning, you always have to start out as an out-of-network provider, which is probably why you're coming up with a lot of, uncovered services. But Coastal Turning Town offers services for those who are privately insured. And you know, all of our, we've had no trouble really getting reimbursement from the insurance companies, and for the out-of-pocket expenses, we can provide scholarships and things like that. Beacon Health Strategies is kind of new on the scene with Central Coast Alliance for Health. They've contracted, Central Coast Alliance for Health, is the way I understand it, is that they have contracted Beacon Health Strategies to manage their mild to moderate mental health group. Mm-hmm. And so if somebody doesn't meet the severity level to be provided services at County Mental Health, they are usually approved for individual counseling and psychiatric services, psychiatry services through Beacon Health Strategies.
But who pays for that?
The Medi-Cal.
Oh, but if you're not on Medi-Cal.
If you're not on Medi-Cal, then Beacon is, that's primarily, yeah, yeah.
So I do want to say one thing about, and I agree with, I'm not a big fan of insurance companies either. But I want to say that in regard to transition age youth, we've kind of loosened up some of our knows about that, you know. So that's people that are up through 25 years old, you know. So I'm just letting you know that we've gotten a little more liberal about taking those folks in, because we know eventually they're going to outgrow their parents' insurance or other insurance, and they're going to come into our system of care anyway. So we need to be working with them now. So if they're at a level of high acuity and stuff like that, we've really kind of change some of our thinking about that, and that's been more recent, but that's true.
Can I also say, I think that it's so important, it's because at Second Story you can't get in without being somebody that's in system of care, and that usually means Medi-Cal and Medicare. And I would just say we've had conversations over the past couple of years I've worked with NAMI for a very long time, as long as I've worked with Second Story, so I've had that dialogue of can we offer a couple of spaces for people that are NAMI family members, and trying to reach out to them in that way. The conversation gets started. It doesn't always follow. There's not a lot of follow through. It can get dismissed very easily when we have very strict criteria. But I would say, like I always say, is if you want something, don't ask for it. Say we're going to need this now, and really expect it, and create the environment where you're united. You're grassroots organization. If you want something, you say we're going to need this now, and we're servants. We're civil servants. The best we can do is. You're asking, your expectation is you're getting it from us. We're gonna do it. It's gonna happen. It's not a petition. It's a demand almost. I don't want to say demand. That's a little bit of a harsher word, but just stay united and make it happen.
And the board of supervisors is the strongest conduit to kind of make those kind of advocacies.
That's my problem with my son. He's 34, and the police and the system. Says he in the state of California, he's an individual and he has rights, and I have no control or say about anything that has to do with him or his mental health care. So he's in the system, but I don't even know if he has an advocate or a counselor or a doctor, or I don't even know what's going on, because I'm not privy to that information.
Right.
Does he live with you?
Yes.
So I know your voice. I take
Do you
these,
want to take him?
No. I mean, I just want to say that this is it's another area that I'm really working with our staff, is to try to find ways to have conversations with parents in particular where there isn't permission to talk with you, because the law does. I understand how that works, but there are also ways that we at the county and other places too
But we can
talk about kind of general protocols. We can give information. We can say, we can kind of give you hints, but we can't give you. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Because the law doesn't allow me to do all that stuff. But I get a couple calls a week of folks saying, you know, what's happening with my son or my daughter, and they've come through the psychiatric facility several times, and they go, what are you guys doing? And then I look them up, and I find out that we're not even seeing them because they're refusing care.
Exactly.
So, but I can't tell you that, you know, because the law won't allow me to do that, because
but
I don't
I
have permission
that's
to.
Happening because yeah. I know his state.
And it's, so it's awkward.
His mental state.
It's terrible, yeah.
Isn't there a way when people sign up with the county or receiving care that they can give permission
absolutely
for a family member
absolutely
to the person has to sign that release
yes
though.
Right.
That's right. So
my son won't sign the release.
This is the dilemma. Yes.
Can you talk
talk a little bit about the outpatient system and the shortages that are going on right now? That, like, my son hasn't been able to see a psychiatrist in 3 months, and his appointments keep getting canceled and rescheduled to the point of even going and finding out he's not on the schedule again. Exactly. So it's been really frustrating, and what are you doing to rectify this?
So we are trying to woo psychiatrists. We have lots of openings. I mean, that's the truth of the matter. I probably every other week I'm interviewing a new psychiatrist and trying to get them to come in. I hate to say it, but one of the contributing factors is the cost of living here in Santa Cruz is so high that even psychiatrists, they get here and they oh, this is beautiful, and we try to really bring them in, and we do all these nice things to kind of woo them into being hired, and then they start looking at the cost of living, and sometimes they just go, they go, I can't afford it, you know. But we're woefully understaffed right now. The good thing is that we actually have places to hire people into, but the difficult part is getting those positions filled. So that contributes to long wait times.
Have you done advertising outside
of? Absolutely. Lots of advertising. They're doing all kinds of outreach stuff. In fact, our new thing is now literally when psychiatry, and we got the Board of Supervisors to endorse a bonus to bring psychiatrists in. We've really done a lot of different things to try to bring people into the system. So, I'm sorry.
Med school.
All of the above. No, I'm serious. And we've also, Board of Supervisors recently approved bonuses to keep psychiatrists that we have so they don't move on.
How about housing?
Well, that has been discussed. I've been in rooms where we've talked about having some sort of housing offering for psychiatrists too. So we're trying to brainstorm about it. Yes.
I wanted to just return for a minute and sorry, Keisha, I didn't mean to paint you all with the broad brush when it came to insurance coverage and how excluded we can be from any services. But it is the fact that aside from Keisha's program, there's nothing at the subacute level for the insured. And the only things we've been able to find are out of county. And are you guys aware of anything that we have found at the subacute level? Something like Clinton Story would be fantastic, or other, for the story.
Well, again, what I'd say is if it's second story, we could take on people that were at not system of care. It would probably take maybe a group of people talking to Carol, talking to Eric Riera. That could be a way of and I'm also, let me know when that's happening, and I can also engage in that conversation. Mm-hmm. I mean, just as far as practical steps for opening space for people, it's been discussed before, but we've not been able to break through that. And there's no one at fault. It's just there's not really a drive to do it.
So he's talking about Eric Riera, who is our mental health director, but I want to say the issue is around the money. You know, and I mean, I'm going to, even though I'm a county employee, I really want to say that the place to advocate is at the Board of Supervisors level. That is really where that stuff.
You said that before, and so I wonder what would one say? Like, we need access to these services even if we have a level of insurance coverage.
So when are we all going to the next Board of Supervisors?
Yeah, there you go. Imagine all these people at the Board of Supervisors.
Right, all these people going to the Board of Supervisors.
You don't have to tell them Marty told you to go. just
to...
Marty,
just to hear with him, man.
He might be leaving town.
Well, I don't know what you think you're saying, but when it comes to private insurance, there are places that are not in Santa Cruz County.
Right.
So if you need something temporary...
There's going to be a public meeting in May. You know, you're talking about advocacy, and I encourage you guys to go. We'll be sending out information about that, and so will the county. They're looking for community input. So there's a GAPS document you can take a look at and see what's on the table, and they want to hear from us. And
and the information about that is?
That's on your county website. Okay. But I can also put it, we'll send it out. If you're on the NAMI newsletter, we are going, I communicate that way. So
I'm up for taking a couple more questions. I don't know what the folks. Yes, so you, sir?
One of the things in my professional life, I was a teacher for 20 years, I was a principal for 20 years, and as I became more involved with NAMI and did research, realized that for many people who are diagnosed at a later age, the signs of some form of mental illness starts when kids are in high school. And I noticed that you said that there's going to be a facility, I believe, which will be kind of a drop-in facility. It won't be where they will take 5150s, but that facility, my understanding, is going to be right next door to the facility that exists across the street from Harbor High.
That's right.
The thing,
it's an old veterinarian building right now.
Right. And the good news and bad news is, and I think it's the same for the mobile crisis unit, is you say, well, that's wonderful. That's going to be a great facility. That's going to be able to address the needs of families. The problem is you say, well, when's that going to be available? Well, it'll be 9 to 5, Monday through Friday.
Yeah.
So, I mean that makes me say, like, Dominican Hospital, close your emergency room on weekends and only operate from 9 to 5. I mean, the good news is it's going to be offered. The bad news is knowing kids as I do, that's not when they have problems.
I agree with you 100%, and I want to say that there is already a will at the Board of Supervisors level about this, even though we haven't rolled out this service. We're looking at kind of what the use is and kind of the responses in the community and how it's utilized. But there's already active discussion about evening hours, weekend hours. That's already, I mean, I'm letting you know that that's, I really see that in the future. You know?
I've had the opportunity to sit down one-on-one with two members of the Board of Supervisors and say that this is an issue. And I don't say it's an issue just for Santa Cruz County. It's an issue throughout the state, actually the whole country. But I think I would ask that all of these people, you might read something about it in the paper, and you can advocate and start writing your letters there, go to the Board of Supervisors meeting. And
a lot of the supervisors have office hours, too.
Yeah.
They want you to come and talk to them. They've been very receptive when I've called as well. So you can figure out who they are and then go and see them.
Especially since the election's coming up, you know.
Yeah. So, yes.
So I actually, as a lifelong organizer, I wanted to say that it's much more effective if you do exactly what you said. If you talk to them, if you talk to them individually in their offices. I found when you go to a board meeting and raise an issue without that back work, nobody likes to be hit in the face with something. Yeah. And the talking to your supervisors in their office is really important as a way of developing a relationship with them, because they need to hear what we have to say. I haven't been dealing with this so, and then I have a question. I haven't been dealing with this so much recently because of the person who, my brother, passed away, so it's been not. But when he was living in Orange County, and when I was trying to get him into Santa Cruz County, I was told at the time, now this has been a few years, that you just can't bring anybody in from out of county, that there's no way that they can get into the system. And I also had that private pay versus public pay issue. So I'm wondering, I mean, is that still the case? Is that, because I think a lot of us who have people who have problems are terrified of our loved ones leaving the county for a temporary thing and then not being able to get back into the system.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So, So it's.
Do you
understand
what I'm saying?
Yeah, I do. I think so. So if we're talking about Medi-Cal, Medicaid, that sort of thing, mm-hmm. if your residence, it's wherever your residence is. So if you move back here and you're a resident of this county, you can apply for benefits here, and then you're entitled to go right through the front door and receive all those things.
And then
the other thing that I mentioned before, which is that there really has been, and it's a fairly recent phenomena of kind of loosening up around transition age youth in particular, you know.
So how long do you have to be here to be a resident?
You know, I'm not a benefits rep, but I don't think it's that long.
I thought it was something like 30 days.
It might be a month.
It might take 30 days for the transfer, but you don't have to be a resident for 30 days. Because we just had somebody who was a Santa Cruz County resident and that was going to be moving to Santa Clara, and all of the paperwork got done ahead of time so that
when they
the scene was, yeah, so if there's some planning, it's not a sudden, like, I'm getting on a bus. And,
some people
yeah,
who are
right.
in that state aren't able to do that kind of thing.
Very true, yeah. But you don't have to establish right. some residency,
right.
but the transfer takes time.
So, yes.
Yeah, so I'm glad we're talking about it today. You mentioned earlier that you're trying to loosen the sort of qualifications, the narrow qualifications to receive services for Tay by loosening up the Medi-Cal and Medicare requirements. What does that look like, I'm wondering, on the ground when people are, I'm guessing, 5150, this assessment there, but like when people walk into Building K and use the assessment tool, aren't they just screened out as mild to moderate?
No. So
okay.
Sometimes that happens, but also currently now, if people are deemed really meeting the level of care of Building K,
mm-hmm.
Whether they have private insurance or not, what I've been told by my director, Pam Rogers
yeah.
Wyman, is we're now taking those people in. And I'm telling my staff that also. So that's really, that's a shift, you know.
The question was, I just wanted to hear about transition age youth having different requirements for Medi-Cal, Medicare, that's supposedly lifting and loosening a little bit.
And what I'm talking about is actually the people that we're doing that with, we're not getting any reimbursement. There isn't, I mean, that's what's happening. You know.
I also have a second part to this question. I'm wondering if you could speak briefly about I understand there's a family advocacy team starting up with the county. What that is, what that looks like, are they going to be working with NAMI? I just heard about it, so.
So, I haven't been in that room.
Okay.
You know, so.
What is Building K?
It's at Emmeline campus. So, a lot of folks refer to it as Building K because on that campus, that the mental health building where adult and children's
right,
mental health is,
right.
that's Building K.
Oh.
It's also
the
1400.
The hand building.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
And we should probably close soon, but yes.
One of them is I'm in the hospital, and I'm wondering what services are available in South County.
Yes, so at the Crestview Center, we do have a whole clinic down there also. We don't have walk-in crisis set up and the access gate quite the same way, but we do have assessments down there, and people can be scheduled down there and stuff like that. Usually staff are, if someone walks in there, staff will scramble to try to accommodate that, but the main front door is in Santa Cruz at Emily.
And what about the services once they're in the
services absolutely in South County.
South County.
Absolutely.
Okay. And then my
psychiatrist, case managers, therapist, all that.
My second question is about the Alvarado Center.
Yeah.
Could you clarify the costs, who pays and how much?
So we at the Alvarado Center we do charge the board and care rate.
Could you explain what that is?
It's the allotted amount by Social Security that we can charge for people's stay there. It's about $30 a day.
Okay.
Yeah.
But if they're on Medi-Cal?
The majority of people we get are on Medi-Cal. It's not really a consideration when we accept people what their insurance is. Normally we accept most people that are referred. I'm not in charge of the billing function or an administrative person. I run the program, so pretty much once people get through the access gate and they're referred, we take them. We do charge the board and care rate for while the person stays there, though.
Board and care isn't covered by Medicare.
their Social Security.
Yeah.
It's both. Billing, Medi-Cal pays, and then people pay out of their Social Security.
And bill is the same thing?
Yeah. It depends on whether people have money or not. If folks don't have money, we don't charge them money.
So if someone was charged $900,
yeah.
What would they do? If someone had been charged $900 for using for Eldorado, what would they do? What would you recommend they should do?
I'm sorry, I'm not understanding the question.
You mean if they get a bill?
Someone's family member was charged a $900 fee for use of Eldorado.
We would set up a payment plan with them.
But they would have to pay it?
We ask that people pay rent while they're there, yeah.
The family was charged or the person?
The person that had no income?
We do ask that people pay rent while they're there. If they can't pay, we don't send anybody to collections often. I mean, most of our rent bills aren't paid. So it's a function of how our program stays afloat. About $100,000 of our yearly budget goes from rent collection. So the program wouldn't be able to operate without the rent collection. So it's part of how we keep our services afloat.
And if it's $900 for 30 days, you're paying rent somewhere and you charge a less.
Right. If someone lives in their own home or apartment and they're paying rent elsewhere, we only charge $15 per day. Yes?
I'm wondering if you know where to go for some advice or assistance on so, make a long story short, my family member had Shelter Plus certificate, whatever it's called, Shelter Plus.
Section 8.
Well, but it's more than just Section 8. It's like the Shelter Plus. And as a result of a break, was incarcerated, was evicted, and also lost his voucher. So he's currently living with me, and I'm wondering if I was able to provide him with housing, but would need to be reimbursed for that housing up and above his, you know, $800 Social Security, he wouldn't be able, or disability, he wouldn't be able to pay rent. Is there somewhere I could go to address that? My understanding is that it's more in the county, it's more of a housing shortage of places for people to go, Section 8 housing,
yes,
than it is really a funding issue,
yes,
per se. So if I was to provide him with a place to live.
Are you a family member?
Correct.
Yeah, I have an experience with that.
It wouldn't be in my home, it would be a separate building. And I could even, you know, do the Section 8 and whatever I need to do.
So I'm not sure, but I'm happy to talk. I mean, I'm happy to give you my number afterwards, and I'm happy to kind of poke around and find out the answer to that.
Awesome. Yeah. I've made a lot of calls, and so far I haven't.
Yeah, I'm happy to ask.
Okay.
Yeah, I provide rent for my son by giving him a discount with market rate and what he's paying. So SSI deducts the difference from his benefits.
Thank you, everyone. Yes.
Thank you.
Yes. Thank you.
Thank you all so much.
Yeah, thank you. This guy?
I'm gonna bend your ear.
I don't want to. Yeah, thank you. Okay.
I should have brought cards and I didn't. I apologize.
So
I'm pretty good at tracking things down. I don't know what the answer is.
How do you feel actually, position, like,
I'm a program manager for acute services, so I oversee the contracts with all these people. So I oversee all the contracts with all these people here, except for the first point, the second facility. And I oversee access to Yes.
So you're in charge of those programs?
Yes.
So I have a question. I'm going to write down the question.
Yeah, 4935.
4935.
And I should have brought cards.
For a transition age to your assumption that has private insurance,
So, how old are they now? Because I know if you come into the system earlier, there's all kinds of independent ILS programs, but I don't know if you've started or I don't know. But you've got my number. Call me again. Okay. Feel free to ask. I'll put. But I don't know of anyone that you know where you can link into that at that age. It's almost like you've got to do a little bit more. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
We should have you
without their blocks. We pack it up.
I'll be right back.
We take good care of it. And hang on to it. There's no real time for it. I mean, we try to work. Is this somebody who is in the campus? We contact the coordinator, we reach out, we say, look, we've got some stuff here. So, yeah. Can I write down my number for you? And I'll be glad to look. May I write down the number?
I actually have one card.
I should have brought cards.
I know, I don't know.
Yes, that's the program number. Ask for me. What's your name? Say the full name. Lodmila. I remember that. Okay, what do you prefer? Okay, call me if I'm not there. I will call you back as soon as I get the message.
And you have like labels?
Yeah. Do we have anything? We lock it up so no one can get away and all that kind of stuff.
Okay.
When was this? Like Marty indicated, it's challenging without releases to talk to people, and I also hear you if you want to find some stuff. I'll do my best. Oh, the green card.
Oh, that's big.
Yeah, it's huge.
Yeah, it is.
So call me and I will.
People who work in the health, they're so irresponsible. I just wonder, like, who hires them? And do they have any general screening when they hire them? the warm up and the heat, because I you know, many times I almost die because there is no help.
Yeah, Marty and I were just talking about planning for this, about how can we at least train folks, even if there's confidentiality, they can't say anything, they still have a compassionate conversation, not just, you know, how we can do that better.
You know, how I learned about this,
And what would a psychiatrist,
they're only seeing such matters that the consumer for 15 minutes might break
through.
Well,
I know people use the law, because it's not only the law. They look at the law. Like, I never did, you know, makes me sleep. You come, like, any facility, like, in the run.
This is pretty amazing.
And they won't tell me anything. And I'm just asking, where is my mother? I'm waiting for her. They won't tell me that.
Feels like we're losing the law, not only against you. We also,
I think. This is crazy. I call your home, your house, and they tell me where you are, right?
Somebody called me, I will tell you where you know my
relationship. Why is it around the health because they try to hide, they try to isolate themselves, they get afraid of everyone, you know, this is what it does. It's so simple, you know. Why they start doing this to mentally ill? Like, I was waiting for my daughter, I don't know, 40 minutes, you know. Eldorado was supposed to be the bus. We were going to the fingerprints, you know, for the post, you know. And they wouldn't even bring you to bus, you know. So they just let her go, you know, and she's stuck in a different spot, you know, and I was waiting for her. They would do nothing, you know. They will not even move a finger to find her. And she has no phone, nothing.
Nice presentation. I'm rolling.
And I'm like, what's frustrating for 40 minutes? Bus. I need to get a bus. I need to go to Salinas, you know?
It's a really terrible
thing.
Even if
this,
This is why they losing themselves more and more and more, because they cannot find help that way. You know, if you tell, if you put this mentally, if you put in their head that their relatives are their enemies, this is what it does.
You don't understand.
Your relatives, your enemies. We protect you from your relatives. We will not tell anything to our relatives. This is what it does. You know, this is craziness.
It's almost like,
you know, like when my daughter was discharged from Eldorado, because I tried to take care of her, you know, in addition, because I saw that they did not take care of her. So what they did, that guy, bold guy, he lied. He's not truthful guy. Every single word he bought, he lied. You know, he threatened me to call the sheriff. You know, when I came in the morning, early in the morning, because my daughter was disoriented, she even fell, you know, walking, and she was like completely, you know, what they did with the medicine. And I was worried, I couldn't sleep, you know, all night, I couldn't sleep, because
because I was worried a lot. And I called access team, nobody returned me call. And as a result, when early in the morning, I was by Alvarada to talk to her doctor. He met me there and threatened to go to Shelley's. And he threatened me to not come anymore to Eldorado. This is what they do, you know, to keep parents away completely. And he also instructed all the staff to do it the same way. They were not in order to see anybody. If they so great, and if they so good, so they, why are they afraid for me to come, you know, and talk to a doctor? They permitted me to come and see a doctor. Yeah, doctor allowed me, and it was recently. Yeah, they discharged on February, and I lost her again. You know?
Excuse me, I must go. But yeah, please call me, and I will do my best to find something out for you that you need to know.
Yeah, okay.
And if I'm not there, I leave a message, and I will definitely,
I'll definitely
call you back.
Yeah, they didn't tell me what the facility she's staying in. You know, nobody looked for her documents, for her staff, not coordinator, not conservator.
I'm hearing you loud and clear that you're not happy with the way that whole thing went down.
Oh my gosh, this is crazy.
I'm getting that loud
this
and clear.
This is crazy.
And I feel you.
This is, and what it made for me, you know, I was supposed to reapply for her green card, and
they began
to build obstacles for that, obstacle after obstacle, that I wouldn't succeed to get her replacement. So what is going
on? It's maddening for me. It's just completely just frustrating. Yeah.
I guess we were being recorded, huh?
Apparently.
Yeah.
Are we still?
No, you will hear.
Let's go off the record.
No, you will hear my voice.
Yeah. That voice needs
I switched
heard.
It to hold.
That message.
Because that's really a private conversation.
Well,
we have
I
here.
You know, I almost, you know, wanted to stop that guy to lie because it's just, you know, and he looks scary and he acts scary, you know.
Who's that?
What, that in the middle, that guy? You know, and whatever he said, it was not true. Because he just boldly lied. Completely boldly lied. And my daughter was on her way, you know, to finally, you know, to get her independency. We were waiting for benefits, and they discharged her. Right, you know, she didn't get it yet, but they discharged her, and I lost her again. And I didn't finish, you know, her business yet. At least, you know, at El Dorado, at least I knew where she is. I could come and pick her up, you know, and go with her, do things. And now I can't, you know, so we still have unresolved stuff, and I cannot move forward because I don't know where she is. And the county spent the money, you know, somebody paid for her. Do you know why? Why it's wasted? Do you know, people like that who is in charge to manage program, they should be answering, do you know that? Why they treat people like that? Why
if you
they
want to talk a little bit more, I just need to go to the bathroom.
Yeah.
To hold that. I'm drinking a lot of water. So if you want to talk more, I'll come back. Or if you want to call me, we'll talk on the phone.
I'm still here.
Okay, can I leave my stuff here?
Yeah.
I'll be right back.
Okay.
Hey, look who's here. Are you going to, you hang it for me?
Therapist with social life, so you
takes me to the stretch, but I can tell they look more like tendinitis. He's got some bruises on his head. So we don't get that. Okay.
I started the program. I mean, not just by myself, but I was part of the group that started it. Before that, I was working down in Watsonville in this program for about 8 years.
See, mentally ill people, they need help every day, at least at the beginning.
Especially when the crisis has happened.
Yeah.
Not just help, but even a place that could hold them when they're not doing well, without getting on.
Yeah, but I mean, do you know, in that point, relative who cares about them, who really can help. So why somebody, do you know, will push relatives away? You know,
why would somebody do that?
Like,
well, that's
like for me, like it's like a sabotage, you know. Like people try just to keep people, do you know.
Oh, why would the program keep? You mean why would the program push the family away, or why would somebody push their own family away?
No, I mean the program.
It's fear of being sued. There's legal requirements, and it's they're. On the one hand, it's like, okay, we want to protect this person, their privacy, their rights. Some people, here's the thing.
I don't know how to end it. Is it any way to end it? Because mentally ill person doesn't understand what is the best, what is the worst.
I respectfully disagree with
but
that.
But they're vulnerable, you know?
But some people, they don't want their family around because maybe the family has harmed them. Some people get harmed by their families.
Well, yes, of course, so
the law is designed to protect them, but what it happens is it like you said, it isolates somebody even more, and it disconnects families. So what I do,
turn this off. I don't trust this thing.